The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
It's a very difficult custom. We spoke about it a little bit last night. And if it makes you feel uncomfortable to see someone you want to say hello to and not to say hello to them, then that's good. Because I think that's how we're supposed to feel. And I think we're actually supposed to take that feeling of being uncomfortable about not saying hello and sort of keep it there the rest of the year and allow it to teach us that we should always want to say hello. There is no day in the Jewish calendar where we come more face to face with the concept of evil than this day. It's a very powerful story. And it's one of those stories that on the one hand contains tremendous pain, and on the other hand contains tremendous faith. The Blues of a Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Spira, by the way, you can read this story in Yaffa Eliach's Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. It's a magnificent story. A magnificent collection of stories. It is, as she suggests, perhaps the first modern collection of Hasidic tales in 100 years. The Blues of a Rebbe, after he was in the Yanushka Road camp, ended up in Bergen-Belsen. There was a section in Bergen-Belsen for foreign nationals. It was just one more of the Nazis' crude jokes. It didn't really give you anything except that you were behind this barbed wire instead of behind that barbed wire. But the theory was that because you had passports and you were members of or citizens of foreign countries, that you had a better chance of getting out. And I wonder if the illusion was sometimes more difficult for many of these prisoners than the reality that faced everybody else. A few weeks before Passover, before Pesach, in Bergen-Belsen, a few Jews came to the Blues of a Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Spira, with a very strange request. I'll be honest with you, I don't know where they found the audacity to make this request. And I don't know that they imagined that they would ever succeed. And the strength that it must have taken them to even consider this possibility is to me quite amazing. They came to the Blues of a Rebbe and they wanted him to go to the camp commandant with a very simple request. They wanted to know, because Jewish law forbids the eating of leavened bread, of chametz, during the week of Passover, so they wanted to know if the camp would be willing, not heaven forfend, to give them special food or special matzah, but instead of giving them bread, just to give them the flour and to allow them an oven, and they would bake the flour into matzah on their own. They wouldn't be asking for anything extra. In fact, it would be less labor for the camp. So they couldn't imagine that there would be a logical reason, but of course, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And they wanted the Blues of a Rebbe to ask the camp commandant to give them this flour so that they could have matzah for Passover, to celebrate their freedom. Now you have to understand, it was a very dangerous thing to be known as a rabbi, as a rabbiner on Passover. You didn't really want the Nazis to know that you were a rabbi, because they used to single out rabbis for special treatment. And so, up until that point, the Jews had hid the identity of the Blues of a Rebbe, so that nobody should know who he was. So what they were now asking him to do, basically, was to put it all on the line. Because it would be quite clear that if he went to the camp commandant, that they would know who he was, or at least know that he was someone special. And it probably wouldn't take much time after that to find out who he was. In Bergen-Belsen, you didn't want to go to the camp commandant for anything. And they had written a petition, and about 70 of the Jews had signed their names to this petition. This was a very dangerous thing to do, to give the Germans a list. Because the Germans had all sorts of uses for lists. But they felt so strongly that they wanted somehow to find some way to effectively communicate their need to celebrate somehow Pesach, Passover, in their Egypt. So the Blues Rebbe considered the request, and while on the one hand, the halakha teaches, v'chai bahen, you're not supposed to put yourself in a dangerous situation, on the other hand, how could he refuse the request of these Jews? This request born of a fire of faith. And so he agreed, and he asked one of the SS guards for an audience with the camp commandant. I imagine the camp commandant must have been quite taken aback at the thought that any Jew would want to talk to him. So he agreed. And one day, two SS guards came, and they half pushed the Blues Rebbe to a meeting with the camp commandant. And when he stood before the camp commandant, hat in his hand, and gave him this list, and asked him if he'd be willing to give them flour to bake their bread on Passover, the camp commandant started to laugh. A horrible, evil, cruel laugh. The Blues Rebbe, while walking to the camp commandant's office, was convinced it was over. He didn't know that he would ever leave that office alive. And he looked at him with gleaming eyes, the camp commandant. And he looked at the paper. And he said, I'll have to ask Berlin for special instructions. And with that, they took him away. Now, I've never understood exactly what that meant. I don't know that we're meant to understand what that meant. I don't know that we can understand the mind of a human being that reaches that level. But a few weeks went by, and Pesach was coming. Closer and closer. And the week before Pesach, the Jews started to despair and to imagine that they wouldn't get an answer, and that they weren't going to get their Passover bread. And worse, that they had given a list to the Germans. And you know, the Germans used to do something that was very cruel. They would always organize selections right around the period of the holidays. God forbid that the Jews should gain some pleasure, some joy from their holiday. They would make a selection, usually on the eve of or the first day of the holiday, so that the Jews would actually dread the coming of the holidays. And so the Jews started to talk among themselves and imagine that such a selection was coming, and they weren't going to bake matzah, they were going instead to be the matzah, and what would be. And one afternoon, when they were in the barracks, in between work details, 3.5 days before Passover, two SS guards with a capo stormed into the barracks. And you can't call the entrance of an SS guard into a barracks in Bergen-Belsen an entrance. It's a storm. And everyone went quiet, and people cowered in their corners. Sparrow! Number 34953! And when we saw Sparrow, looked up. And they took him off, running at a pace. And a tremendous wave of grief swept through the barracks. Because people understood what had happened. And when we saw Sparrow was being half marched and half beaten to the S-Commandant's office, and he began to say the Vidui prayer, convinced that he was being summoned to his death, hoping it wouldn't be worse, that he would, heaven forfend, have to give some list or bring over the names of those who had made the request. And they finally ushered him into the SS commandant's office, and they stood him at attention, and the same evil grin. And the SS commandant said, Berlin has decided to be magnanimous to its Jews. You can have your flour. You can send me two workers who will build you an oven, and you can bake your matzah. And with a laugh, the Blues Rebbe was ushered out of the valley of the shadow of death. And he couldn't believe his ears. And they went back to the barracks, and he told the good news, and someone actually made a blessing, the Berchat HaGomel, a blessing for good fortune having befallen you. And indeed, two workers came and they built an oven, if you can call it an oven. And they received flour, such as it was. And they were able to bake matzahs in Bergen-Belsen. Now, I don't know if you can call them matzahs, the way he describes them. They were little black, burnt, charred, puffy things. It wasn't exactly an oven, and the flour wasn't exactly flour.
The only thing they didn't have to worry about is that there's a halakha that you're not supposed to let the bread rise. You have to bake the matzot in less than 18 minutes. They didn't have to worry about whether they would find the time, because there was never any time in Bergen-Belsen. And they baked matzahs. And the night of Passover came. And the same type of question that must have occurred to them every day and every Shabbat: should they gather for a Seder, or should each try to celebrate the Passover on their own? Having a religious gathering in Bergen-Belsen was a crime punishable by death, which, by the way, is why I barely understand this story. But they decided to get together in the barracks and to hold a secret Seder. And of course, the Blue Rebbe led the Seder. And he said, "Tonight we read Avadim Hayim, we were once slaves. We have no wine, no four cups to celebrate our redemption. Our redemption is not yet at hand. We have no charoset, we have no Seder table, but we have plenty of bitter herbs. This year maror is in abundance. And let the abundance of our maror justify the lack of everything else." And with that, they sang in a barracks in Bergen-Belsen the Haggadah of Passover. Very difficult. How do you sing Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves, in Bergen-Belsen? How do you sing Ata B'nei Chorin, now we're free? So, notwithstanding the response, and I wouldn't deign to call it an answer, that we discussed last night. I mentioned last night that there was a question, Gedo and Kovno, whether we make the blessing of Shalom Asani Eved, that God has not made a slave. And if Ephraim Ashuri ruled, not only should you make that blessing, but that blessing is not about physical slavery, but about spiritual slavery. And it's a blessing which communicates the fact that we are never slaves, that we always have the potential to find and to be spiritually free. But notwithstanding that, how do you deal with this? I mean, one of the difficult questions of the day of Tisha B'Av is how I deal with evil. And there is no day more in the Jewish calendar when I come into contact with this evil, with this absence. And you read in the Eicha, "Oy Hashem, me'ayalan, what has become of us?" And Jeremiah writes the Book of Lamentations, "Eicha yashva badat ha'ir, rabat yam." The city that was once so full of life now sits so desolate. And I want you to know something. There are different types of desolation. There are desolation that comes from without, and desolation that comes from within. And there is a desolation that you can find, and you don't have to go to Nazi Germany to find it. You can go to Idaho, you can go to Vermont, you can go to New York City, you can go to Los Angeles, and you can say, "Echai Ashva Badat, how lonely doth she sit, the city that was once so full of people." You know, there's a song. It's a Jewish group. I think it's called Journeys or something. I don't remember. But it's about a dollar bill. And this dollar bill is floating through the air in a synagogue. And the synagogue is completely empty. I once went to visit the synagogue in Harlem. Now, there's a Jewish community in Black Harlem at the beginning of this century. And it was a thriving Jewish community. And they had Jewish schools. And they had synagogues. And there's one synagogue today, it's actually an evangelical church. It had been a pool hall. You can still see the Magen David. And there are still a few Jews who live up in Harlem, because they're too old to go anywhere. And there's a synagogue on 125th Street, off Amsterdam, between Amsterdam and Broadway. I believe the name of the rabbis were Kretz. And I went to visit his shul, and it's still an active synagogue. Students from Columbia University, Jewish theological seminary, go and support the synagogue. And there are a few lonely Jews who live in this community. And you think, "Echai Ashva Badat, where are all these Jews? Where are all the thriving Jews?" How do I deal with both sides of this question? How do I confront the pain that is Tisha B'Av? The desolation on the one hand, and the destruction on the other. And they're two very different things. So I want to give you a few perspectives. And I have to be honest, sometimes you can have a discussion, you can give a class, and it's a very organized structure. I don't think Tisha B'Av is meant to be that way. So I'm really going to share with you a collection of thoughts. And I'll be honest, the opportunity to give this class gave me an excuse to do something I've been wanting to do for a while, to pursue a couple of particular articles that are written up in Yesh Kodesh. I mentioned last night the Rebbe of Piasetzner, who was the last, one of the rabbis in the Warsaw Ghetto, who did not survive World War II. And the Yesh Kodesh, the Holy Fire, is a collection of his works. It was found after the war and published. And they were literally teachings on the portions of the week that were taught by Rav Kornelius Kalman in the Warsaw Ghetto. And I want to share a couple of them with you. And I have to tell you, I would not dare to say some of the things that he says. But because of where he's saying them, and who he's saying them to, I think I'm able to be challenged by what he says. You know, one of the most tragic figures in the Talmud is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest Torah scholars in Jewish history. There's even a Talmudic Agadah, a legend, literal or allegorical, doesn't matter, where Moshe is actually taken by God to the base Medrash of Rabbi Akiva. And Moses, in the Agadah, walks into the Beit Midrash where Rabbi Akiva is teaching, and he sits down on one of the back benches to hear the shiur. And he doesn't understand a single word of it. He doesn't understand anything. And he's incredibly frustrated. Until one of the students asks him a question, and Rabbi Akiva answers, Allah kala Moshe Nisina. This is a tradition we have from Moses. And then everything becomes clear. Notwithstanding the meaning of that story, that's a very powerful story, you have to understand it's not accidental that the Talmud chose Rabbi Akiva to be the one about whom this story is told. That was Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had thousands upon thousands of students. And he represents many things. He represents the idea that it's never too late to start. He was a total ignoramus, a shepherd. And the Talmud says that he was walking once through the forest, and he came upon a stream flowing into a stone, and he realized that the stone had been worn smooth by the dripping water. And he said, if a drop of water can round out a stone, then the heart of Rabbi Akiva is not closed. He fell in love with the daughter of Kalva Sabua, a wealthy man from a well-to-do family. Wasn't interested in Rabbi Akiva marrying his daughter. He was a shepherd. He was named Ramus. He realized that she wouldn't have him, or perhaps that she wanted more. And he went off to study Torah as a man of 40 years old. At 40 years old, Rabbi Akiva went to a Talmud Torah to learn the Aleph Beis. He went away for 12 years. When he came back after 12 years to his home, his wife was so poor, she was selling her hair in order to support herself. And he came, according to the legend, upon his house. And he heard Sarah, his wife, Rabbi Akiva's wife, speaking to someone. And the someone was saying, what are you waiting for? He's gone off for 12 years. Why bother? He's not coming back. And she said, would that he would stay away another 12 years and become a Torah scholar. And he heard this and he felt it was a message. He didn't even go in to say hello. He went back another 12 years. Now, notwithstanding the difficulty that that paints in terms of relationships, Rabbi Akiva became the greatest Torah scholar of his generation. And when he came back finally to his home with thousands of students, Rabbi Akiva represents patience. The willingness to put it on the line and to struggle. And to understand that it doesn't come from today till tomorrow. Talmud tells us that in a space of 33 days, in the period between Pesach and Shavuot, perhaps 32 days, called the Omer, 24,000 of Rabbi Akiva's students died. It was one of the greatest tragedies of the generation. Rabbi Akiva himself was tortured to death. And there is an opinion that the students of Rabbi Akiva die in the Bar Kokhba rebellion, because Rabbi Akiva was a progenitor of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. But that's not what the Talmud says. How do you deal with this type of tragedy? And what I'm struggling to understand is how Jewish sources, in the face of such tragedy, of such destruction, of such pain, were able somehow to find solace. How do you do that? And I want to give you just an example from a totally different world, which set me thinking a long time ago. You know, there was a study done on prisoners of war. I have a very good friend who's been missing in action for now since 1982, Zach Powell. And Hashem only knows what hell he's been through. And God should grant that he returns to us soon. But when I was in the army, because I have a friend who is missing in action, so I was a little phobic about this. And one of the reasons he actually fell into captivity was because the sergeant of his tank didn't really know how to properly navigate. We know this because his sergeant, Chazi Shai, was exchanged in a prisoner exchange 2 years after their capture. And essentially, when they were off their tank in the middle of enemy territory, it was still daylight. He didn't know how to navigate. They didn't know which way to go. They were in the middle of enemy territory, surrounded by Syrian troops and tanks, while they watched their own tanks pull out. And they couldn't do anything about it. And he decided that they should split up into two pairs and go in different directions in the hopes that one of them would reach Israel. And this story had a powerful effect on me. Not just as a soldier, but as a sergeant and later as an officer. It's an awesome responsibility. God forbid that you should ever be in such a situation. You want to know that you do the right thing. So I became a little bit, I'll be honest with you, fanatical about this, about navigations, about preparations. I remember just running around the mill trying to figure out whether or not if I was ever interrogated, I should tell them that I was an American citizen or not. And I read a number of studies. How does one behave as a POW if you're captured? You know, the Syrians, I discovered, send special... That's my mother. You can't get away with saying the other side.
Give it up. Give it up.
She's checking up on me.
Checking up on me.
She's doing well so far.
She knows that everything you gain from this class, you owe the woman who just sat down. I remember reading this study, an unbelievable study, and I became fascinated because Syrian, see, I wouldn't say this in front of my mother years ago, but now I can say it. But if an Israeli soldier is captured, they send interrogators, you know, from the local army unit. But if it's an officer, they send special interrogators from Damascus. And I remember reading this, and you can imagine that this did not exactly sit well with me. And the Israeli army had precious little to offer on how to deal with interrogations. And I had this fear because of this friend of mine, because of Zach, you know, what I do and if I do the right thing, etc. And I learned lots of things, and I read one study on POWs from the Vietnam War. You know, the prisoners of war who came back from Vietnam, what they had been through was beyond anything we can imagine. I mean, I remember reading of one soldier who was held in a bamboo cage on the Mekong Delta. If you ever wash dishes and your hands get old, you know, if you really wash for a while, right, those of us who are good sons, right? If you ever wash for a while, so your skin gets all wrinkly and, you know, it starts to peel, whatever. Imagine being in water for a year. Your skin starts to fall off. And there were water rats in the water. And so they got all sorts of infections. And the tide would rise, and the only way they could keep from drowning was to lock their arms in the bamboo cage and to hold themselves that way until the rain stopped and the tide went down. And so they got all sorts of problems and rheumatism, and their joints would lock and they would be in terrible agony. And most of the men who were in this particular bamboo cage finally succumbed and allowed themselves to drown. And this was a study of one particular person who was in this situation. And occasionally there was like a long, the way it's described, a long bridge sort of that led to this cage in the river. And you could hear the footsteps of the interrogator as he was coming down the road, down this bridge. And they knew that whenever this person was coming, that it meant tremendous pain. They did electric shock torture and cigarette burns and God only knows what else. And the question was, how did these people deal with this pain? I mean, if you're in such a situation for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, how do you deal with that? You know, Terry Anderson was a prisoner who was taken prisoner by the Hezbollah, I believe, in Lebanon. He was a Christian, I think an Anglican minister, who was captured in Beirut. He was held for almost 8 years. He describes that the first 3 years of his captivity, they kept a bag, a sack around his head with only a hole for his mouth. And he was chained to the wall like a dog for 3 years. 3 years he couldn't see he was in a bag. How do you keep sane? How do you keep from going absolutely mad? And they found, in fact, statistically, that there were only two responses to this type of experience. Either you went completely insane to escape your reality, or you learn to love the pain. I mean, how do you live knowing that pain is waiting for you? You learn to love the pain, you embrace the pain. And in fact, you can imagine some of these people came back, sadomasochists, with very, very difficult situations. And you can imagine that this plays havoc on a healthy relationship, you know. You're married and your husband loves pain, it's not exactly healthy. And these people went through tremendous, tremendous difficulty. And the truth is that that started a whole different thought process for me, not just in terms of my being an officer and how I was trying to prepare myself for, thank God, that which never happened and hopefully never will. But what about the Jewish people? The Jewish people have been a prisoner of war for reasons we can't hope to understand for 2,000 years. How did the Jewish people keep sane? How did they keep from going completely mad? You know, I read a story from the Inquisition. And I think it's very, very important to read these stories to appreciate how lucky we are to be here and how much we've been through to get here. And this particular Jew was a Marano. And he was living in Spain. And they would have a secret minion. You know, we don't appreciate the Jews who stayed in Spain. We think of the exile, those who left. There were many Jews who, for the right reasons or the wrong reasons, we don't know, stayed in Spain. And they outwardly embraced Christianity, but secretly, Judaism stayed alive in their hearts. You can still, by the way, go, I read an article, to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and find Spanish women who light candles on Friday afternoon, they know not why. Right? There are Jews in Spain today. Very strange things. How the spirit of Judaism just will not die. And there's a story about this particular Jew. And they catch them in the middle of Minyan. They're having a Friday night service. And the Inquisition comes in. And the story is written from the vantage point of a man who is describing the story that happened when he was a boy. And as a young boy, they had, this family was a wealthy family, so they had prepared certain secret hideaways under the floor of their basement. And the father, realizing that they were looking for him, and realizing that they would continue to look until they found him, knew that he couldn't get into this hiding place. Because then they would tear apart the house until they found him. So he takes his son, who's 7 years old, and he throws him in this hiding place. I want you to know I have a 7-year-old daughter. I can't imagine what it must have been like. And they begin to torture this Jew. And the other Jews of the community, one at a time. And first they begin by cutting off his fingers. And then they begin by putting out his eyes, and they cut off his tongue because he will not utter the name of the Lord. And finally they drag him off screaming. And this boy never sees his father again. How do you grow up as a human being when that's what you see as a 7-year-old? And I want you to know something. How many Jewish 7-year-olds saw these things? I mean, there's a sefer that's written, the Gates al Mavet, the Valley of the Shadow of Death. It's written by a tremendous Torah scholar who went through the Chmelnytsky massacres. I think I mentioned this yesterday with the students. And he describes what happened when his village was set upon by Ukrainian Cossacks in 1650 in eastern Poland, in Ukraine. He was a young man, he was married, and he heard a strange sound in the middle of the night, and it became like a thunder in the distance. And he thought it was very strange in the middle of the summer, a thunderstorm. And he went out of his little shack, his house, and all of a sudden he realized what the thunder was. It was the thunder of hoofs. And he tried desperately to awake his family, and he couldn't succeed. And he managed to jump out the window, and he watched as the Cossacks tore through this village in the middle of the night and turned the river that ran alongside in the valley below their village into a river of blood by moonlight. And he describes how he watched his mother killed. They took his mother, and they tied her to four trees, four young saplings, her arms and her legs, and then a Cossack rode through her. You know, Khmelnytsky and his hordes killed anywhere from 300,000 to 1.2 million Jews in about 4.5 years. This was before there were machine guns, before there were carbon monoxide vans, before there were gas chambers, before there were trains. And you have to wonder at what type of hatred, at what type of energy it takes to do that with your hands. But how did we remain sane? I was telling my class this week, you know, we consider the Holocaust to be an event that's just beyond our capability of understanding. And we very often focus on the survivors. But I can't tell you how many times I've met people who are children of survivors. And how can you not have pain if you come from that? And if you think about it, all of us, every living Jew, has ancestors who went through such tremendous tragedies, such tremendous agonies, that they should not have been able to even communicate sanity, let alone bring up their children. And when you think about the collective sufferings of the Jewish people over the last 2,000 years, it is amazing that we're all safe. How did they do that? How do you find an answer to that? So I want to share with you two ideas in backwards order that come out of the Eish Kodesh, with Tronimus Kalman of Piazetsna. And I'll be honest with you, ever since I have discovered this Sefer, every time I read a part of it, I discover new thought. I actually recently discovered, and I never knew this, that there is a book written, and I actually brought it here to show it to you. There's a book written in English now. I didn't know this. I thought it was only in Hebrew. By a guy named Nehemiah Poland called The Holy Fire. I started looking through it. It's not really a translation of the book. It's an analysis of it. But it does say, take certain pieces of it. And he actually discusses these two pieces, which is one of the reasons I chose them, so that if anybody wants to look it up afterwards or photostat it or whatever, I'll be. There's a very, very difficult section in the Torah. Sometimes Hashem asks of us things that are very, very difficult. And we don't always know how to respond. And I'll be honest with you, you know, when we sit here at Israelite and we study mitzvot and teach, one of the things that I always say is, you know, and the Rambam discusses this in Maimonides, it's a very dangerous thing, from one perspective, to begin to philosophize and analyze and understand mitzvot, what it is that Hashem seems to want of us, because I might imagine for the moment that my understanding is the reason for my fulfillment. And that's not true. And here I can only speak for myself. Anybody here who knows Israelite knows that I'm not ever saying anybody else should take anything upon themselves. But for me, the reason, for example, that I won't eat pig is just because I believe that there is a God, and I believe Hashem tells me not to do it, and therefore I don't do it. All of my understanding and all of my philosophy and everything I've come to discover about the beauty of that mitzvah and how it can make me a better human being is not the reason I do it. That's the value that I give to it. And that's how doing it makes me better. But if tomorrow I found out that everything I had come up with was wrong, I would still do it. But there's no mitzvah that I can think of that more captures that idea than this mitzvah, the mitzvah of Amalek. And the Torah, very difficult passage, at the end of the portion of B'Shalach, in the book of Exodus, describes a very difficult story. In the portion after the splitting of the sea, there are a couple of very strange stories. I won't get into the exact story of Amalek. Amalek was a nation, a warlike tribe that lived in the desert, it seems. Amalek himself was actually the grandson of Esau, which will become important. And there are a couple of very strange stories at the end of the portion that we call B'Shalach. The Jewish people have just gone through the sea. And they have just seen God's hand in a way that we can't even begin to imagine. They are on their way to Sinai to receive the Torah, to receive meaning and purpose. And they get out of the Red Sea, and there's no water. And they're upset. And they have a whole discussion. They complain to Moshe. and it's called Masa and Meriva. And eventually Moshe solves the issue, him, God, whatever, and they get water. By crashing a makom in the name of this place where the people complained and argued with God and with Moses, Masa and Meriva, the argument. Alumiv bnei Israel, because of the argument of the people of Israel, the al nasotam et Hashem, because they tested God, saying, "Leimor, Hayesh Hashem b'kir bein limayim, is God amongst us or not?" It's a very strange portion, because it follows the story of the Red Sea, and they're on their way to Sinai, and by the way, they're getting man every morning, and clouds of glory are leading the way. The next verse is Vayavo Amalek. And Amalek comes out of the desert, Vayilachem in Yisrael b'rufidim. And they do battle with Israel at a place called Rifidim. And it's interesting, the rabbis have a field day with these two verses. Don't think that this is a new story. Because the story of Amalek comes because the Jewish people say, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbein v'mayim. And the way the Talmud reads it is, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbein v'mayim v'yabu Amalek. And the people said, is God amongst us or not? And Amalek came. You want to forget that I'm here, says Hashem? I'll send my messenger, Amalek, to remind you. And it's a terrible battle. And it's a very strange story. Moses says to Joshua, pick men, go out, fight Amalek. And they fight and they do battle. And eventually the Jewish people overcome. Moses is up on the mountain, he's lifting up his hands. Every time he lifts up his hands, the Jewish people succeed. Don't think that your success in battle is you. Remember where it comes from. But the strangest part of this story is the end of the story. And by the way, I'll tell you one more thing. You have to understand this. Amalek is a nation that comes out of nowhere. There's no description as to who they are, where they come from, or why they come. They just come. And God says to Moses, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, K'tov zot zikaron b'sefer. Write this to be remembered in the book, in the Torah. V'simbaz ne'Yoshua. And put this in the ears of Joshua, the next leader of the Jewish people. In other words, the Jewish people have to know this. Ki machoim chet, zech Amalek. I will wipe out Amalek from under the sky. And Moses builds an altar and says, Ki yad al kes ka, milchama al Hashem ba'amalek midor dor. Literally, he offers up a sacrifice, attesting to the battle that God will have from his throne in war with Amalek from generation to generation. And it's interesting that the word for throne here, case, is spelled incomplete. It's missing an aleph. An aleph is the first letter, it's the smallest of letters. Because it's just one letter. But as long as Amalek, as long as this battle exists, the throne of God is not complete. That's what the rabbis said. Even stranger is the flip end of this story. You remember last night I said that Moses repeats the stories that happened to the Jewish people in the desert in Deuteronomy to the second generation. And he repeats this story. And in this particular instance, it's a little strange. It's at the end of Parashat Ki Tetzé. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, this is in chapter 25, verse 17, Parakafei Pasuk Yitzayim. And Moshe says to the Jewish people, to the second generation about to enter the land of Israel, Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek. Remember that which Amalek did to you. Baderech, bitzeitchem mimitzrayim, on the way when you came out of Egypt. Asher korcha baderech. Now that's a very difficult word. It may come from the word mikre. They happened upon you, or so you think, on the way out of Egypt. Vayizanev b'cha. And they came from the tail, zanav. Kol amecha shalim acharecha. They attacked the weak in the rear. Yata yef, yageya, you were tired. V'lo yarei Elohim. And you did not perceive God. And you can understand the Torah is expressing here the real meaning behind the battle. V'haya be'aniach Hashem alokecha lecha mikol oyvecha misaviv. And it will come to pass when God will let you rest from all the enemies around you. Ba'aretz, in the land. Asher Hashem alokecha noten lecha nachala levishta. In the land that you are given as an inheritance. Timche et zecher Amalek. You must erase the memory of Amalek mitachat hashamayim, from underneath the sky. Lo tishkach. Do not forget. It's very strange. The story of Amalek is very strange. I won't get into it. That's a class for another time. Clearly there's a partnership here. Hashem says that Hashem will erase the memory of Amalek. But we are told that we must erase the memory of Amalek. And I want you to know, that's a very difficult mitzvah. Even King Saul wasn't able to deal with this mitzvah in its entirety, having mercy on one last member of Amalek. And it's easy to understand the mitzvah, it's much more difficult to fulfill it. If I was told tomorrow morning that we had identified the entire nation of Amalek, and if I was in a situation where I was in my land, and there was a king, and a Sanhedrin, and a temple, and it's not clear that we have this mitzvah without that, but I won't get into the halach question. But if that situation exists and I was told to destroy Amalek, then I would have to destroy Amalek just like I don't eat pig on Yom Kippur. Every last Amalek had a very difficult answer. Not just the men coming out to do battle. Not even just the women teaching the children the evil of Amalek, whatever it is. And even the babes of Amalek. How do you deal with it? And so the rabbi suggests, and I'm not going to get into the question I just raised, it's good if you have questions, but the rabbi suggests that Amalek represents evil. Rav Soloveitchik of the last generation believed that any nation that rises up with the express purpose of destroying the Jewish people is Amalek in our day, and he believed therefore that Nazism was Amalek. And while that doesn't mean that we have the ability or the halachic allowance to go out and do whatever one might think one might do, the battle to destroy the philosophy and the theology of Amalek is a fulfillment of this mitzvah. Very difficult. How do you deal with Amalek? Amalek comes out of nowhere, where you least expect it. How do you deal with evil? So I want to share with you an unbelievable perception from the Eish Kodesh. And you have to understand that this perception was written in the ghetto of Warsaw in March of 1940. And this was a lecture that the Piazetz and the Rebbe Rifonimus Kalman gave on Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat before Purim. Haman was a descendant of Amalek who tried to destroy the Jewish people. And therefore the Shabbat before Purim, we traditionally read this section from the Torah. And generally we study this mitzvah and what it means. And you can imagine that this was a very powerful question in the ghetto in Warsaw. And that giving a drasha on this topic was not easy. I want to tell you, by the way, an interesting thing. You will not find mentioned anywhere in the Eish Kodesh the word Nazi, or for that matter the word Germans, or for that matter the word Germany. He will never refer to the Nazis as Nazis. He calls them the emissaries of Amalek. Incredible sensitivity in the Talmud, for example. The Makom Sarim, which is the hidden place, which is how the Talmud refers to a woman's sexual reproductive organs. Relations is called Tashmish Hamita, the use of the bed. A bed can be a physical item, it can be elevated to bring beauty into the world. And I think that the Eish Kodesh was following this tradition and elevating even that to something we can learn a message from. Listen to what he says with an eye towards understanding where he's saying this. Zachor et asher asah lecha Amalek. Remember that which Amalek did to you. Asher korcha. Remember I said that this is that they happened upon you. You know, the Jews in Nazi Germany must have felt, where did this come from? I mean, they were laughing at Adolf Hitler 5 years before. He was a nutcase who had tried some kind of a putsch and he was thrown in prison. And nobody read his book. He was even a lunatic. And 5 years later, he was the prime minister. He was the chancellor. And they must have said, where did this come from? Very frightening. Etc. And when God will allow you to rest from all your enemies, erase the memory of Amalek under the sky. I want you to understand the Hasidic mindset. For one thing, the ability to embrace a mitzvah, wherever I am, is an incredible power. How do you fulfill the mitzvah to erase Amalek in the middle of the Warsaw Ghetto? How do you do that? It's everywhere you look. And I want to tell you also that there are two different perceptions towards dealing with evil.
towards seeing evil. I can see evil in the sword held against my throat, or I can look for what I have to learn from that evil. Rosh Hashanah Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Chassidut, has an unbelievable idea. He says, if you see someone committing a transgression, it means that you have to work on that transgression. If I see the desecration of Shabbat, it means I need to work on my Shabbat. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking about what that means. Does it mean that I have to elevate myself and my Shabbat to the level where I don't see someone else doing something as desecration, but I look for the beauty in it? Or does it mean more simply that I have to work on this? I'm not sure. I remember once when I was in yeshiva, I was actually, it was before I was married, but I was already starting to study to be a rabbi. And so I was like, you know, one of the older guys, and you would sort of get along with some of the younger guys in yeshiva. And I was doing guard duty. And, you know, we used to have to do guard duty patrols, even when we weren't in the army, around the yeshiva area, over the green line. And the new arrivals, especially the young Americans, you know, first year Israelis before the army, they would always make sure to pair them up with somebody who was older. And usually guard duty meant you happened to have a rifle on your back, but it was an opportunity to walk for 2 hours and have a deep discussion or whatever. And so I was schmoozing with this first year American, whatever, and we were talking, and he starts to tell me a joke. And I started to realize it was a dirty joke. And I couldn't believe that this guy was telling me a dirty joke. But I didn't know how to stop him from telling it without embarrassing him. And it wasn't like you can say, well, I have to go now, because you're in the middle of a 2-hour patrol. You know what it is. So I tried switching the topic. He didn't get it. So he told me a dirty joke. And I was thinking about this afterwards. And at first I was so upset. A chutzpah, tell me a dirty joke. Chutzpah. And then I started thinking about it. You know, this guy must think that I'm the type of guy you can tell a dirty joke to. So I guess that means that I have to work on myself. Because nobody would imagine going over to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and telling him a dirty joke. And I wonder if that isn't the perception we're supposed to have from that statement of the Besh. If I see someone driving a car on Shabbat, it should cause me pain if I value Shabbat. But the message should be that I need to do something, because if my Shabbat was so incredible and so great, then no one could drive by me on Shabbat and not get out of the car and want to join me. So maybe we can't reach that level in this world, I don't know. But at least that's the goal. It's interesting that Chassidut has the same perception of evil. You can look at evil and struggle with it, or you can look at evil and try to figure out what you're supposed to gain from it. That's a very, very high level. To try to figure out what I'm meant to take from this. And it seems to me in the two articles I'm going to share with you that that's what the Piazzetzer is trying to do. V'navina, let us try to understand ma mitachat hashamayim. What does it mean, erase Amalek from under the sky? It doesn't say erase Amalek from the ground. And the Aretz, the ground, the land, that's where Amalek is found. Because the sky, the heavens, are the place of my throne, and my throne is incomplete until Amalek's descendants are erased. You have to erase Amalek from the heavens. Now, I've long thought about what this means. It's no big deal to physically destroy Amalek. We did that in 1945. But that doesn't mean that we finished, because the theology, the ruach, that which seeps into the air, into the heavens, is still there. But he goes a stage further. Odef Shah. I'll give you another possibility. And you should know that in rabbinic literature, whenever you see the words Odef Shah, I'll give you another possibility, it means I'm not 100% satisfied with the first one. So I'll give you something else to think about. Ki ita b'medrash, it says in the medrash, al asher korcha, milshom kulut. Asher korcha baderech, that they happen to cross you, no. Korcha reminds me of the word kar, cold, ice. Mashallah, bati chama. Well, okay, I won't get into that. It's a Gemara. Efshar shekirer ita korcha shekirer et Yisrael atzman bekirut. That Amalek made the Jewish people cold. V'navina, eich haya yachol Amalek
שהיה שונאם. ובא להרגם חס ושלום עוד לקרר אותם. How could the same Amalek who has come to kill and destroy them succeed in making them cold? What does that mean? ושישמעו ישראל אל שונאם ומבקש רעתם. How could it be that the Jewish people actually listened to those who hated them and wanted to learn from them? אבל מרמז לנו גם לזה. כי איתה בספרי, there's a great allusion here. Now he gets into a little Kabbalah here. I'm not a Kabbalistic expert, but I'll tell you what I think it means. He says there's a tremendous, tremendous secret here. It's found in the Medrash, rabbinic legend. בחידושי מחשבה, thought. Now, a second, let me find this. Kodim Sheba Amalek Lehilachem Lachem. So before Amalek came to do battle with you, Hayu Bachem Anashim Nimuchim Shechachmat Chitzoniyut Shehitba'er Bahem Amalek Hayta Yafeh Be'enichem. There were men of low stature who saw great beauty in the wisdom of Amalek. U'bishvil zeh nitkarartem me'hatorah. Now I want you to know, I don't know that I have the audacity to say this. And I want you to know that nobody should jump to conclusions, but I understand the connections. But I'm quoting to you what the Piazetzner Rebbe was saying in the Warsaw Ghetto. And when he talks about Amalek, he understands who he's talking about. Before Amalek came, there were those who saw great value and great beauty in their culture. And therefore you became cold from Torah. The fire of Torah didn't burn within you. The Chochmat Torah, the wisdom of Torah. There is so much beauty in the wisdom of the world. The Gamlami Dotovot, and it has so many good perceptions. And we can find so much in this world. So God brought Amalek with all of his wisdom. Hashem Nusehu al Shechmo, that he carries on his shoulders. The Yigalet Kolushal. And allowed you to discover the failing of that wisdom, the evil that it can lead to. Zohimet libo, that it pollutes his heart. Ritzichat midotav, that there's a danger that it can destroy his ethics, his character trait. Barikvon chachmatav, and cause his wisdom to work. V'kvar ro'im atem et ha'emet asher ba'etzem chachmat ha'olam. And so you see truth within the wisdom of the world. Gam b'sfarad asa Hashem came, so did God do in Spain. Shehayu mibnei Yisrael asher nimshechu achar chochmatam ufilosofia shalahem. Ve'achar kach amdu aleihem ve'enoihem hanimadim ve'gashu oto. What does this mean? Well, I'll tell you what I think. I'm not so sure I'm right. And I've learned with the H Kodesh you have to struggle with it again and again. We spoke once here at Israelite about the failing of an ethic that does not have an objective source. And you can't misunderstand this because there is tremendous beauty in the world. Not just the world of art, not just the world of music, but the world of philosophy. You read Goethe, you can read Nietzsche, you can read Kant and Kierkegaard and find tremendous source of inspiration. But I wonder if the H. Kodesh isn't saying that it's not so easy to see sometimes where it falls short. You know, the Jews of Germany before the Holocaust, and God forbid no one should understand from me that I have the audacity to suggest that there's a connection. I don't understand it. And I'm not so sure that that's what the H. Kodesh is saying either. He certainly doesn't come straight out and say it. But in the period before the Holocaust, the Jews of Germany embraced German literature and German music. How many times is there ever a play or an article that describes how the Jews fell in Germany that doesn't have someone saying it can't happen here? Not the land of Beethoven and Bach and Mozart. And there is so much beauty in that world. But it's a dangerous thing when I look at beauty and I make it an idea.
It's a dangerous thing when it becomes the ends instead of the means. Where did these Germans come from in 1933? They were the same Germans of 1932. The same Germans who flocked to the theater in 1925. In fact, I'll go you one further. Do you know the German opera house never closed through the Holocaust? In 1945, as late as March, with the city of Berlin completely surrounded, the theater still ran. Because the importance, the ideal, was that the theater, the show, must go on. How easy it is to lose sight of the goal of that idea. Do you know why music is beautiful? And here I'm giving you my perception of what you do that is up to you. You know why I find music beautiful? Because music helps me to appreciate the world that I was given by a shot. Do you know why I find art beautiful? Because when I look at a painting, I look at a Rembrandt, and I all of a sudden try to see where the light is coming from, and it gives me a whole different perception, then the world is a better place. And I have greater appreciation for what I've been given. But if I look at that beauty, and I don't glean that message, then I'm missing something. And one of the things that Rav Clonimus Kalman seems to gain from the Holocaust, if we can ever understand this, is that this evil that's around us, it's the same. These are the people we went to theater with 5 years ago. And you know, Jews had such a hard time with this. I want you to know, if the Mongolian horde had come out of the Northland and swept through and done exactly the same thing, it would not have created such a difficult problem for the Jewish people. Theologically. It was because of where it happened. Because the height of intellectual elitism, of culture, of magnificent perception, could steep to such a depth that the Jewish people found themselves in an abyss that they couldn't even crawl out. How do you deal with that? And the Eish Kodesh is saying, that's Amalek. What does it mean, lo tishkach? Erase the memory, but don't forget. Either erase the memory, or don't forget. It's not so easy to see Amalek. And I don't think that this means, God forbid, that I'm supposed to look at my fellow human being, the American citizen who lives down the block from me in Connecticut, and that I should imagine that deep in his soul there is evil and he's plotting to kill me. I don't think that's the way to look at it. I think too many people in the world have a black and white perspective and things are easy. I think that we have to see the danger in losing that source. If there is no source for goodness, then there is no source for evil. And ethics become what I want them to be. And that was what they were struggling with. And that's Amalek. And he goes on. The HaTorah meramezet, and the Torah alludes to the fact. Zachor et asher asah lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. Et asher asah lecha, lecha be'atzmecha. Which he did to you that you did to yourself. Because it doesn't have to say, remember what Amalek did to you. It should just say, remember what Amalek did. Asher korcha baderech, b'machshava shelcha, shepa'al b'chaleimor shechachmato yafei. Because you became so consumed with this love of culture, love of beauty, that you forgot that there was something deeper. The kvar acharoei. I gotta tell you, I read this. You can't read this. It's painful to read this. Because he's sitting and telling this to Jews, and I want you to know, they didn't have a section for ultra-Orthodox Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. It wasn't like, you know, they had a reform minion and a conservative minion. It didn't work that way. You got to the ghetto, and they assigned you a place. And a room like this would probably hold something like 30 families. I mean, you have to understand. I read a description in a diary. I think it was called Young Moshe's Diary of the Ghetto. And he describes how he had to share with 4 other families an apartment that was barely fit for one. And families couldn't live together. You couldn't have couples living together because they were all in one room. So the husbands would be in one room, and the wives would be in another room. You didn't even get to lie at night with your family in peace for a moment. There was no room. And so the atheist was next to the Vishnitzer Chassid. And they were all in the same room. And it doesn't say that when they sang Ani Mami, I believe, on the way into the chamber, that only this group sang or only that group sang, or they argued about what tune they should use. Because they finally realized that they were all singing the same song. And who is the Eish Kodesh saying this to? He's saying this to them in the Warsaw Ghetto. And it takes being in the Warsaw Ghetto for them to finally understand this message. And I find myself saying, why didn't he teach this earlier? Why weren't people listening to this in 1925? We weren't ready to hear it. Now look at the magnificence of this. Because he's looking Amalek in the eye. He's walking by the Nazi beast. And he's thinking, what can I learn from you? What can I gain from this? What am I meant to take away? Not in my physical existence, but I'll be here today and I'll be gone tomorrow. What am I meant to take away in my soul? What can I leave behind which can't be destroyed? And that's the story of Amalek. That's a very powerful message. And I want you to know the message of Amalek. You want to understand mourning in a modern state? You look around at your world. What do you do with it? What do we learn from it? What do we take from it? What is it meant to give us? Rabbi Akiva. You know what the Talmud says? 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died in the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And the Talmud doesn't say that they died because they were poor fighters. It doesn't say that they died because they desecrated Shabbat. It says they died shalom nagu kavod zebaze. They did not treat each other with respect. And I want you to know, it doesn't say they have to agree. The essence of Talmudic study is that I can disagree. And there's nothing like a good argument in a base medrash. And if you go to my yeshiva, you'll see hundreds of guys and they're yelling at each other. But there's a beauty to it, because it's done out of respect. And I can hear your opinion, and you can hear my opinion. And you can be right, and I can be right. You know what I mourn over? I don't know the whole story. I don't want to know the whole story. I was sitting with a student last night, this morning. He was saying that there was a minion, and I heard that they were coming, whatever. It's a group, and I don't like to use labels. I'll use the labels just because you'll understand the story. I don't have time to explain to you what my perception of what these labels really mean are. We spend too much time labeling each other. You know, it's like before Pesach. Everybody spends time labeling all their cupboards. This one is Pesach, and this one isn't, and this one is dairy, and this one is milk. You know, but do they open up the cupboard and see what's inside? So there was a group last night that came to pray at the Kotel. I don't know what they called themselves, reform, conservative, liberal ideology, loving of peace, wonderful. And there was another group that didn't want them to pray at the Kotel. And I don't know what they called themselves, ultra-Orthodox, we like black, whatever you want to call them. And they didn't get along. And the group that was coming didn't get to come in. Someone told me that the group that was walking away, calling themselves religious, patting each other on the backs. And don't think for a minute that I can define for you who is religious in that group and who isn't. I have no idea. I don't think that's our job. But that should cause me pain. It should cause me pain. From both sides of the fence. You know, when we go to Meir Shearim once in a while in Israelite, so we take a tour in Meir Shearim. And it's not a simple thing to go to Meir Shearim. First of all, it's not a simple thing because a lot of our students, you know, don't come necessarily from a background where, you know, it's fair to expect of them the types of things that you really need to do to go into Meir Shearim. And I would never want, God forbid, to offend a student by telling them, wear a skirt, don't wear a skirt. Same time, I know if you go into Meir Shearim in certain sections and you're not wearing a skirt, you know, you wear a bikini, let's say, so, you know, it's not going to be a pleasant experience. So how do you balance that tension? And I look at it as an exercise in sensitivities training. Me being sensitive to the people who are coming with me, them being sensitive to the community they're going into, the community being sensitive to the fact that they're trying to be sensitive. And I want you to know, in Baruch Hashem, the Baruch Hashem should grant, it always succeeds. I've never had a problem yet. Because if you take a group of people and you put them on two sides of a street, men on one side and women on the other, because you want to be so sensitive to where you're going, not because you think that's the way you should walk, not because you think there's an educational value in that, but because the act of being so sensitive to someone who you disagree with, who, by the way, you think is completely wrong, not just halakhically, but ethically, morally, educationally, but the act of being sensitive, of having respect for their opinion, even if you disagree with it, that's an uplifting experience. And that's the tragedy for me. If two groups can be more concerned with why they're right and why the other is wrong, then vice versa, then they've missed the whole meaning of Tisha B'av. And they've created anew the whole reason for Tisha B'av. That's how the Pizetsu deals with the world around him, with evil, with destruction, with pain, and then different types of pain. And we can spend life thinking what should be done. We can even spend life thinking what we should all do. At least we should spend life thinking, what can I do? And by the way, before I think about what can I do about that, it would be good if everybody could just think about what I can do for me, how I make me better. And there's so many different issues that come to mind in Tisha B'av. We didn't merit the privilege of learning from the words of Rav Kolomus Kalman when he was alive. He did not die of old age. He died a horrible death. His entire family was destroyed. It's interesting that the Esh Kodesh stops in the summer of 1940. And the last drasha that he gives, that is printed in his manuscript, is Shabbat Chazon, is the Shabbat before Tisha B'av. Then the Actions began, and he, I guess, couldn't give drashot, and was eventually taken away. I don't think it's accidental that the Esh Kodesh leads me up to Tisha B'av, because this book contains for me the message of what I'm supposed to learn. And even though we didn't merit to hear him while he was alive, maybe we'll merit to hear him beyond his death. Because by hearing him in this Esh Kodesh, then he never died. And that's the challenge of Tisha B'av. And if you weep and you cry on this day, it's good, because there's a lot to cry about. But tears are meant to cleanse and meant to make the world better. And that's our challenge. How do we make this world better? How do we make our people better? How do we make ourselves better? You hear that sound? That this should be the last time that we sit together in this room on the floor. And Hashem comes, unites us, and teaches us how to learn to love each other and to live with each other, to respect each other, and ultimately to build the Beit HaMikdash so that there'll be a place where we can all come together. Have an easy fast.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.